at this point we'll start. I'm going to try, the speech is going to be touching a lot of different subjects. I'm going to try to make it quick. I hope nobody goes to sleep. Joe, you see, you're going to sleep already. And at the end, you can ask as many questions as you want. We can get as technical as you want, or we can keep it as high level as you want. It's up to you, depending on how you like it. Let's start with who is a hacker. Over the last 40 years, the definition has changed a lot. Originally, it was the computer gurus, the people that basically had access to the very early computers back then, and they were actually making programs, and everything was done the hard way. They had to be extremely creative, and about in the 70s, the term stayed pretty much the same, just as computers are becoming more accessible and more people have computers, the elite of the people that were actually using the computers became the hackers, or they were called hackers. Unfortunately, in the 80s, we had a bad term that basically hackers became those that were pirating software, and that was the term used most. And today, unfortunately, even more worse, they're called the actual criminals. Because of the role of the media and the way that certain people were presented by the media, those people were actually hackers, but the way they were also criminals. One thing, in my opinion, one thing has nothing to do with the other. You can be... if we take a look in history, and we take it out of context and we use the word hacker for anybody like really imaginative and really creative, the person that will actually find the solution for the problem no matter what the problem is. One of the early examples is Ulysses and his Trojan horse, which funny enough we're still using the term Trojan today on the computers. In my opinion, that's who should be called a hacker. That no matter what the problem is, just find a solution. Just make it work. And this has a very funny title, as you can say, 2600 or less. About 10 years ago, I got involved with this group called the 2600, which is probably the biggest organization, if you want to call it something like that, for hackers. And actually you can find the magazine 2600 in newsstands somewhere. I don't know. It's not the easiest thing to find. It's not the easiest thing to find, but you can find it. Back then, there were a lot of good people working for 2600. Unfortunately, over the years, that changed. Somewhere about 1998, 99, a lot of the good people phased out, and the reason that happened is a few terms start getting confused. As I said before, you can be a hacker and you can be a criminal. One is not mutually exclusive from the other. 2600 organized a few of the hacker conferences called HOPE, standing for Hackers on Planet Earth. The last one was called HOPE5, and that was the banner that they had, and the reason that I have it there is, looking at it, it doesn't tell you anything about hacking. It tells you a lot about activism, but nothing about hacking. And I believe that was the main reason why a lot of the good people that used to be in the group were no longer there. The magazine, there are a lot of good articles, it's still good, but for example, the radio show, it's just not the same, it's just not for me. Hackers in the media. We have the wanted poster from Kevin Mitnick. Most of you heard of them. When I was looking on the internet just to find some graphics, I came across this, and I found something very interesting. You cannot see it here, but here it says birthdays, and it actually has two birthdays. I don't know how he pulled this one off, but if you, he's definitely good if you can get, what can you say? Kevin is definitely a very smart guy. Definitely he has done a lot that he got credit for, good or bad. Unfortunately, as it turned out, he's also a criminal. It's not me saying it, it's the Department of Justice, that was the decision from the court. Because of Kevin and for people similar, there were a lot of high profile cases that they were publicized a lot all over the magazines. The reason for that is that, especially in the late 90s, the internet was the Wild West. So it was a good opportunity for the media to grab it and present everything, exaggerate everything. But as a result of that is the opinion of hackers that we have today. Unfortunately, over the last 4 years, we all became familiar with the color coding of the security levels. This is really nothing new. It's not only for the homeland security, it's also for the network security. It can represent many different things. There is what we call a security incident or an intrusion. There is a small difference between the two. A security incident can be anything. For example, you're going to read your email and you mistype your password. That's really a security incident. It's just not important enough for anybody to pay attention. Now, if this happens a number of times, then there's a good chance that it's not actually you trying to read your email, but maybe somebody else trying to guess your password, and then it becomes more important. Once that person successfully breaks into the computer or gains access to your account, then it becomes an intrusion. The old days, we had a safe cracker trying to break into a safe. Today it has changed a little bit, but still he's trying to break in, but he's breaking into a computer. The network security is very similar to physical security. The same way, the same security that you have in your house. The policies, the security policies, are the written agreements, or the things that you may have, or insurance policy that you may have, equivalent. Access controls and passwords are the equivalent of the keys that you have to get into your house. Windows and doors are what keep the intruders out, and similar to your firewall, etc. And the security cameras are the equivalent of an intrusion detection system that you may have, or some other security monitoring system. Most people have no idea what the network, what kind of data the network has, and the importance of the data. That is really bad because you cannot protect what you don't know the value of. Very often I go and I talk to people and I'm like, okay, which computer should we concentrate about increasing the security? What kind of data do you have? How paranoid are you going to go about protecting them? And usually their initial answer is, oh, I don't have anything important. You can't get more wrong than this. An example, once I was hired to do a security, to break into a network for a very well-known company. I was hired by the CTO, and nobody else in the company knew about it. The purpose was to break in, see if we can break in first, If we successfully break in, show them how we achieve that and try to help them solve the problem. After about 1 week worth of work, we were giving the status report to the CFO. So we told him, yeah, we were successful, we broke in. He was like, wow, you did that. He's like, does that mean you can change our website? I'm like, yeah. He's like, can you show me now? We go to their website, he's like, okay, can you change this word? So while we're still on the call, we change the word for him. He's totally impressed. But he got slightly a little bit more impressed when we told him his social security number and his salary. And that was a wake-up call for him, and after that we did a lot more work and we solved some problems, or I hope we solved some problems. But the bottom line is people don't realize how much information is on their computers. Where do these hackers attack you from? Why do they attack you? First of all, there are two big categories. One is the insiders and the other is the outsiders. The insiders, they're already in the company, they already have access to the computer systems, maybe a little bit low level access. And what they do is they just try to gain access to data that they're not supposed to. That is something that I'm sure all of you at some point try to look at your company's information. Nothing wrong with it. It's their responsibility to try to protect it. And then there are the outsiders. The outsiders is everybody on the internet. For example, there are many more than that. But so basically, they can come in from the internet, they can come in from dial-up, they can come in from wireless, which we'll talk a little bit more later on, since it's the biggest problem right now. Or you can come in from partner connections. A lot of big corporations, the bigger the corporation, the more partner connections there are. There are dedicated lines that they go to some associated company. For example, if you're a hospital, you will have a dedicated line to the healthcare providers, so you can share information. So if somebody breaks into a hospital, they can easier end up to the healthcare provider. Okay, this is something again that we've heard a lot about the last 5 years. There's a number of times that government officials came up on TV and they said that terrorists have the advantage over us trying to protect because the terrorists, we have to be right 100% of the time and terrorists have to get lucky once. And guess what? It's exactly the same on a network. If you're a security expert trying to protect your network, you have to spend a lot of money, a lot of energy, and you have to be right 100%. There is nothing else. You have to have a lot of imagination, and you have to try to anticipate any possible attack. Did I mention this costs a lot of money? So that is the biggest problem, especially these days with the economy the way it is. The biggest problem is that you're talking with huge corporations, and their attitude is, we need security, we know we need it. But when I have to worry about how many people I have to fire for next quarter, how can we do as much security as we want? Also, the hacker has the advantage of time. If you have a specific target that you're going to break into, it doesn't matter. Usually you don't have a deadline. Like in my line of job, I usually have a deadline that we cannot keep trying indefinitely. But if you want to just collect some data, you can keep trying until you succeed. And you can do as much research as you need. Search on the internet, find new exploits, or wait until there is a new exploit. There are new exploits every day. So. There are three different types of intrusion. The first one is the physical. This is the easiest. Basically, you give me access to a computer, I can take the hard drive out, 99.999% of the time, I can read what's on that hard drive. There are very few cases that the data are actually encrypted. In the real world, you don't run into something like that very easily. The rule of the thumb is that if you have access, physical access to a machine, you can do whatever you want with it. Then we have the system intrusion, which is the case where you do have access, you have an account on the machine, you just need, you want to read data or access data that you don't, you're not supposed to. And the third one is the remote intrusion. The remote intrusion, of course, is the most difficult. This is where you're coming from the outside, so you have the problem of first breaking into the network somehow, and then concentrating on one machine or on the data that you actually need. Before you start breaking into a network, you have to do a lot of planning. The first most important is you have to collect information. You have to identify who your target is. You have to identify the plan of attack. Then you have to go a little bit more specific and identify the platforms that they're using, like auto operating systems. You have to identify and collect whatever tools that you're going to need. Most probably you will not anticipate all of them, but at least have most of them. And last, you have to figure out how you're going to cover your tracks, because if you get busted, you lose the game. Okay, now it's getting more serious, so let me take my jacket off. Intelligence, 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 intelligence. You need to know everything you can possibly know about your target. You need to know physical location, you need to know network location, you need to know names of the people, positions in the company. You cannot just start attacking if you don't have this. Otherwise, you will definitely lose. You will never achieve your goal. The more information you have, the easier it will be later on to get to your goal. Social engineering, although it's not really hacking, it definitely helps. When everything else fails, the weakest link on our security is the people that are actually using the systems. So, yeah, if you can do what this guy is doing, just call and say, hey, I'm doing some work on the network, give me your username and password. Sometimes it works. Most of the time it works. Example of that, I'm sure all of you got emails that they claim to be from a bank or from your eBay account or whatever, and they're asking you to give them your username and password and social security number and shoe size or something. And unfortunately, all those work and they get information. So you have to be very careful who you're giving your information to. Dumpster diving, that's a great source of information. These days you can actually do dumpster diving with a super tie. I'm not kidding, I've done it. Thank you for the rules for recycling. All the papers of the important part are nice and clean, stacked up. You just go through it and you find everything you can possibly imagine. Actually, sometimes you don't even have to do dumpster diving. This is like totally weird, but one time I was working for another client that we were asked to break into a hospital. We were successful again. It was a couple of days before we were do our presentation, and I'm walking out of my house and I look on the floor and I see a paper flying with the wind that it was actually from that hospital and had patient information. Total coincidence, there was some garbage truck that was doing the collection that passed by and a paper flew out, but the client did not like when I presented that paper. So for those of you trying to protect your company, you better make sure that you know what happens to all your paper, if it gets shredded, if it gets burned, what happens to it. Otherwise, people can find a lot of information. The good old days, we used to do word dialing, I'm sorry. Basically, during the intelligence thing that we were talking about before, collect some information about the company, find their phone numbers, and figure out their exchange, the first three numbers after the area code, and basically dial every number on those exchanges. Have a program similar to this, and keep dialing until you get some modem to answer, and then it gives you a look at the end, something similar to what you see on the screen, that says, okay, this number, a modem answered. Then the next day you go and you start looking at those results, and sometimes you get lucky. You find a computer with a modem hanging off it, either because some executive needed to access his computer from home, or some partner connection, or some maintenance contract that you bought some equipment from some company, they're doing the maintenance. The easiest way for them to access the machine is through a modem. So these days changed a little. Now we have word driving. This makes things much easier for hacker. Basically, you can be in your car, driving around in the streets, go around the block a few times, and see if there are any wireless networks that they are easily available and not encrypted. Most of the time, probably about 75% of the networks, of the wireless networks out there, they are not encrypted, so anybody can access them. Many of them are in your houses. Your argument would be, okay, I don't have anything at my home, I don't worry. Like, yeah, if somebody wants to access the network, why not? I'll tell you why not, because somebody can connect to your network and break into a bank, and guess where is the FBI going to show up? In your house. So, and that's just a small example, because as we said before, don't underestimate the data that you have on your computer. I'm sure you have a few passwords written down on your computer. I'm sure you have your bank accounts written down on your computer. Or maybe you will type them at some point, and if a hacker is already there, he could get it. Before you start breaking, okay, you collected all the information for the network that you could be attacking. Now you need to define its perimeter. You need to find which machines actually belong to that client and which machines they are for somebody else. Pink strips, they used to work most of the time, the good old days, not anymore. Basically, what you do is you send an ICMP packet, a ping, for every IP number that you know that this company owns, and you see what replies you get. A lot of firewalls are configured not to reply back on ICMP, so something that you don't see as a live machine or a live IP number, it may actually be. And at the same time, two machines can be, two IP numbers can actually be pointing to the same machine. And that's where you start going further and you're doing the TCP scans and the UDP scans. This is basically you're checking what services are running on the machine. Is there a web server running? Is there a mail server running? By identifying those, it gives you an idea if it's the same machine. If it has the same services, it could be the same machine. Also, this would you would use later on in order to exploit the machine. And then we have the OS identification, which basically you're sending an abnormal packet to the machine. And depending on the implementation of the operating system, you get a different reply. Slightly different packets that they can be used in order to identify what operating system that box is running. And once you have the TCP scans and you know what services are running, you can start attacking accounts. For example, if you see that there is Telnet running, you can start trying to Telnet with different usernames and passwords. Again, you collected some information earlier about the names of the people. You collected some information about emails of people. So let's say that you see an email, manos@manos.com. Chances are the username will be Manos. So you start attacking that username. There are a few. You know the services that they're running. Now you have to figure out a way to bypass whatever security is there and try to gain access. That happens because of these reasons mainly. Defining software as either software that you're running or the operating system, because the operating system is also software. When you're a programmer and you're developing a software package, your target and your concentration is to finish and achieve what you have to do, to have the program do a very specific task. Unfortunately, you don't pay as much attention to detail and into how the program how can a user try to take advantage of whatever you're not doing in order to break into. Buffer overflows. I don't know how many of you are familiar with programming, I assume most of you, but let's say you define a string that is going to be 10 characters long. If the user finds a way to enter in that string 100 characters, those characters go in different parts of the memory of the computer, and depending on where they went, they can do a lot of weird stuff and they can take over the computer. Again, unexpected combinations, again, inputs that you were not expecting that the user would give, race conditions, two programs interacting, and something that was not planned at the beginning. That's the bottom line. That when you're trying to write the software fast, you forget about all these things. Yeah. And then we have configuration bugs. Easy to use means usually easy to break into. A nice example of that is SGI, Silicon Graphics. If they're still around, I'm not even sure of that anymore. No, they are, I'm just kidding. A few versions ago, basically, you were buying an indie. It was nice purple box, you were opening, turning it on, everything was there, all the software was installed. And it had about 10 accounts with no password. And that was the default configuration. So, from a hacker's perspective, that was paradise. You hit an SGI box, you can get in, because most of the times people do not bother to go back and change, set up a password for all these accounts. For system administrator practices, for example, using the same password for all the machines. I know it's easy, but if a hacker discovers that password, he has access to everything. Running unnecessary services. The more services you run, the more potential holes are to be discovered from a hacker. So, and trust relationships. In a computer network, in order for the computers to talk to each other or to talk to a server, they assume that they are trusted. They assume that, okay, it's okay for this guy to talk to. Generally speaking, in order to make things easier, a lot of administrators say, okay, we trust everybody that's in this network. Sometimes in this network is the hacker too, so he gains access where he's not supposed to. So we identified the usernames, we identified the services. Now let's start breaking into some usernames, some accounts. So the first thing to try would be username Manos, password Manos. A lot of people do that, or try it backwards, so now. The next thing would be a dictionary attack. There are programs that what they do is you give them the username and they hit that account with every word in the dictionary. If you are using a dictionary word, that program will figure it out. And then of course the most difficult one is the brute force, that basically is trying to guess any possible combination of letters. That's not really feasible. Can it be done? Yes. Is it feasible? Not really. Man in the middle attack. The idea behind this is that think it this way. You're on the phone talking to somebody else and there's another handset somewhere in the house and somebody picks up that handset, actually they hear the entire conversation. Exactly the same idea in a computer world is the man in the middle attack. A few years ago, when everybody was using dial-up accounts, it was a big target for hackers to break into internet service providers, gain access to the modem poles, and try to sneak the traffic of those modem poles. Today, everybody has broadband, so you will say, okay, I'm safe. Everything goes from here, goes to my telco, I'm fine. But today we have another interesting man-in-the-middle attack that some of you will not even realize, but actually Joe brought that to my attention some time ago. A couple of weeks ago, I took my laptop. I have a broadband connection, wireless. I sat down in a Starbucks, and I turned on the sharing feature. So I was sharing my internet connection with a network called Manos. Not even 5 minutes later, I had about 10 people connected to my network. Guess what? Now I can see all their traffic. So they're getting their free internet connection in Starbucks instead of paying T-Mobile or whoever it is, that I can sniff all their traffic. So that's man in the middle. IP spoofing. It's when you're actually trying to hide your tracks and trying to pretend that you're not coming from the IP number that you're really coming from. Basically, you make your own packet and you send it out. The problem with IP spoofing is on TCP connections are two ways. So basically, I'm sending you something, you're supposed to reply back that you got it, or with the reply. So if I'm faking my IP number, the reply would not come to me, it would go to somebody else. But this can be used against the user. If I take a packet and say, okay, I am Joe, since we're mentioning his name all the time, please reply to me, and I send this packet to a million people. Guess what? Joe would get a million replies, and that can bring him to his knees. Or you can use some kind of a DNS attack. A lot of the trust relationships, or basically when you go to www.manos.com, you end up to my homepage because the DNS server told you where it really is. If an attacker takes over your DNS server, the DNS server that you're using, you can type manos.com and you can end up to the Apple website. Basically, you go wherever your DNS server tells you to. And there are a number of cards with the DNS. Denial of service attack, the one that I just mentioned before, about sending a packet to a million people and the request of the packet goes to Joe, that can be a denial of service attack. Basically, you're overloading the target machine and you can take it down. The thing of death was a big problem that actually I was involved with some time ago. That basically a lot of the limitations of a lot of TCP stacks were done wrong. And if you were sending a malformed packet, it was taking down the entire computer. And that was happening with like operating with a lot of different operating systems, definitely Windows. And of course your favorite viruses and Trojans. You open this email with this nice attachment that has, like some funny looking bugs dancing around on the screen or something, and 5 minutes later somebody has access to your computer. They are extremely useful. I never got to resort to this, but I did design a program that, I don't know how many of you are familiar with VNC or PC Anywhere. Basically, it allows you to control the mouse, to do anything on a computer and view the results. The way that those software works is that you have to connect to the computer, the computer becomes a server, and you are the client, you connect to the server and you get all the information. From a security perspective, you have to go through the firewall. You have to initiate the connection from the outside, so there has to be a way to the machine. What I did is slightly different, so basically the machine on the inside opens the connection to you outside, and that can help you bypass most of the firewalls. Just be careful what you're installing, guys. Oops. This slide is actually called Thank You Microsoft. There are so many bugs on the Windows operating system, it's not even funny. Every week you go and you do the software update and downloads for half an hour. Why is that? It's because programmers did not think of what they were doing. So they're going back and they're fixing stuff. To give a little credit to Microsoft, it's not only that. Every operating systems are difficult to write. There is a lot of code that steep deadlines. So it's not really Microsoft's fault. Apple is a little bit harder to break into because they are based on a Unix system, they are based on BSD. Still there are ways around it, not as bad. The biggest problem with Microsoft, in my opinion, is that they're rushing the product out of in the market. So when it's supposed to be a beta, they have it in the market. So you have to wait a couple of years until you have like Service Pack 5 in order for the system to be stable. Covering your tracks. After you broke into a place, there are always, you left signs behind you. There is always a way for somebody to find you. Don't give yourself, there is always a way. You can make it difficult. You can jump from like 5 different networks and it may not even be worth it for them to track you down, but there is always a way. The problem is that nobody is looking most of the time. Unless they have some intrusion detection system, or unless they have some really good people working for them, nobody is even looking at the logs, nothing. To go back to the example that I was giving you earlier with a company with a CFO that we told them his social security number, part of the job was to go back about a month later and interview everybody in the company and see what is their opinion about the security in the company. In order to break into that specific client, we found a modem hanging off an SGI machine that the CTO of the company was using. And we used that, he had some default configurations, it was really easy to break into. A month later, we're interviewing that CTO. So we're like, okay, do you have any security problems? Anything, has anybody broken into your network? He was like, no, never. The poor guy did not realize, like a month later, that he actually used his machine that was actually generating logs and everything, that I personally created, like, at least one account named Manos. I just left it there because there was no reason for me to cover my tracks. I was hired by the company to do it. So he never bothered. On the other hand, there was one guy that was further down the ladder, a very smart guy, somebody that I know, and he actually noticed a couple of accounts manners in the world over the systems. So when we got to him for the interview, he said, yes, somebody broke in, it was about a month ago, it was this guy Manos. We're like, okay, did you report it? I was not doing his interview, somebody else was doing it. He's like, okay, did you report it? He's like, no, you know, I know the guy, he did not do anything, I looked around, he did not destroy anything, he did not take any information. Of course, about half an hour later, he was called at the CFO's office, where he was informed that we actually were hired into the job, and it was okay. But it was one person out of a company that probably employs, I don't know, at least 10,000 people. So, who's also the hackers? If you ask anybody, the first word out of their mouth, the spooks. Who are the spooks? You see a few facilities there, like a few federal agencies. Nice guys, they try to do their job. Unfortunately, they don't do that great job. They have a lot of things to worry about, so I give them credit. Most of the time, it comes to the company to collect all the information, to find everything, and basically the FBI will tell you, okay, give us all the information and we'll prosecute. But then there is another category of people that you don't want to mess with. Nothing against a few Italian people over here. I'm Greek, by the way, so it's okay. A couple of times it has happened to me that I was asked to track down somebody that broke into a network, and that their attitude was, we'll handle. Just tell us who it is and we'll handle it. I found some excuse not to do the job, but I really didn't want to know what was going to happen. A funny story, when you're trying to break into a network, you better know whose network you break into. And you better know what they are capable of. An example, in 95, 96, I was working with a bunch of people here, at an internet service provider in New York, and there was some kid that gained access a little bit more than what he was supposed to. We noticed that about half an hour later, we made a few phone calls, we tracked him down, we knew who he was, we knew his phone number, we knew everything. So we sent him a message of basically, okay, we know that you have access, it's okay, just don't do anything, you know, do whatever you want, just don't do any damage, just be there and, you know, we'll let you be. He was trying to be a little bit of a wise guy, so like the next day he was back in the network, he was trying to do stuff. So we actually got to go to, funny enough, to one of the 2600 meetings, and he had no idea physically who I was or who the other people were. So we went, we grabbed him by the shoulder and like, okay, didn't we tell you don't mess with us? And there is nothing worse for a hacker than have his identity revealed. Like, yeah, he never did anything. Actually, somebody threatened him with physical violence too, but I'm not gonna get there. Okay, and today with all the terrorist attacks that we have, I think we have to pay a lot of attention into network security. Shortly after September 11, it was all over the news that actually the hijackers or other terrorists that were using the internet in order to pass messages along to each other using techniques like steganography. For those of you that you don't know what the steganography is, basically you have an image, it displays on your computer like this, but inside that picture there are other information that you don't readily see, but if you know to look for it, you can find it. So that's one pretty advanced technique that terrorists were using. I have a computer hacker there, and I'm saying that the danger is greater than an actual dynamite. I won't even dare to think of what an actual terrorist with skills, computer hacking skills, can do by breaking into... I won't even go to the Pentagon, because believe me, it's not very easy to break into there, and it's not that great damage that you can do in the Pentagon. Get to some, though. But let's say in a few banks, and the moment that you get into one bank, banks are connected to partner connections that we mentioned earlier to credit unions. And once you're on the credit union, then you can jump into another bank and so on, or in the stock market. So I think we should definitely get serious about securing the networks, and I know it's expensive, as we said, but it has to get done, especially for the critical infrastructure. When we got the blackout, another example, when we got the blackout in New York, everybody thought our first thoughts were that it was a terrorist attack. And guess what? It can happen. They don't need to go and blow up a nuclear plant or something. All they need is to gain access to their computers, and they can shut down everything. So. That's all I have to tell you. I don't want you to go to sleep. So, if you have any questions, I'm here to answer it. And as I said, we can go as technical or as high level as you want. Yes, sir. What value do you see in the The question was, is there real value on intrusion prevention systems? As I was saying earlier, the security of your network is very similar to the security of your house. Depending on how much, what are you trying to protect, defines on how much money, how much effort you're going to put into protecting it. You can never have enough security, and you can never say that, okay, now I'm secure. So the more things you can add into the mix, definitely the better it is for you. Because let's say you have an IDS. There are ways around IDSs. Let's say you have, no matter what you can think of, especially if the hacker has done enough intelligence and knows what you have, he can get around it. And he has the advantage of time. He can take his sweet time and break into next year, whatever it takes. So yeah, the more you can throw into the system, the better it is. Everything is, the problem is the cost. Anybody else? The question was, what can you do with a wireless system? How can you secure a wireless system? Every wireless system that you buy, every wireless access router, comes with a feature called WEP. It will take you about 5 minutes to set it up. Basically, what you do is you go through the menu, the configuration, you set up what is called a shared key. You set up that key on your router, then you go to your computer, and if it's an Apple, and I said that you have, when you try to connect to that network, a window will pop up that will ask you for a password. You enter this password. To make it easier for yourself, just click it save on the keychain, and then you never have to enter it again. But this is very basic. It's not 100% foolproof, but it will definitely protect you from 95% of the hackers. And considering that you're not a high value target. If that's for your house, this is more than enough. It would not be worth it for somebody to try to break into that for your house. If it's for a multi-million dollar business, you better be better than that. So, yes. The question was that if you have a man in the middle, really, and that is actually sniffing all the traffic that is going on your network, how significant is that? Depending on what you're using on top of your simple network. Basically, the moment that somebody has enough power to do that, he can see every packet that you're sending out, every password, every username, everything. Now, thank God there are things like SSL, like the little key that you see on your browser that shows you that it's a secure connection. Now, once you get this, all the traffic that goes on the wire is encrypted. So even though he can see everything, he can see all the packets, he sees encrypted data. Again, depending on what you used in order to encrypt those data, it can be broken. Everybody says that encryption can be broken, no matter what the encryption you're using, again, how much effort you want to put into it. Proof of that was a few years ago at the RSA conference when John Gilmore brought in the DAS algorithm. Basically, he had a number of computers, he had it distributed, it was a lot of work, but he proved that it can be broken. Other encryption algorithms that they are used today, we don't know yet how to break them, but that doesn't mean that tomorrow somebody will just find the key and like break them. But so you need to be encrypting your traffic in order to be sure, and actually web, like I mentioned before, that's what it does. It encrypts the traffic between your workstation and your wireless access point. Did you enter the password? There is no web. So right now, somebody can access your file sharing, most definitely. Turn it off right now. If you have the file sharing, that comes to the other slide that we had about running unnecessary services. So basically, if the only service that your computer is running is the file sharing, and you turn off that one too, then you are relatively secure. Because there is no real... Think of being a room without any doors or windows. If there are no doors or windows, there is no way in or out. So it is safe. File sharing services. That's one of the services. Like if you go to your control panel, you will see they're all together. Basically, you can have SSH, for example, so you can remotely access your computer. You can telnet with your computer, or you can have a web server running. All these are different services. And if you have nothing running, you are relatively safe. If they do what they claim that they do, and nothing more, nothing less, they're only sharing the files that they're supposed to share. But you're taking the programmer's word for it. Basically, if I give you a program and I tell you, this program will do, I don't know, send an email to you, okay? You trust me that this program will do that. In the back end, something else may be happening. So, personally, I'm very skeptical about all these programs. And also, again, these programs were written quickly. They were written to do, to get out there, to do what they were supposed to do. So, I won't be surprised if there are some serious security problems with them, and basically use those problems to get in. Not that we know of. Personally, I don't know of any of those problems right now. But I won't be surprised if there is one like that. That's it.
Instead of posting to the talk list, I thought I'd ask. Does anybody know, do you know any open source alternatives to RSA, Secure ID, and that whole infrastructure system? Anybody know, is there any open source ones?
Secure token,
PIN numbers. Is there any open source implementations there?
Not as far as I know of that.
Yeah,
ESCII is not a token. It's
going to get without a hardware dongle, which you can't get a free hardware dongle. So
no, I don't worry about the cost of like $100 for a hardware dongle. I'm worried about the cost of the attack infrastructure.
Not as far as I know.
It's another ESCII thing. But that's as close as you can get to that sort of concept.
We just started a subcommittee to compete with RSA if anybody's interested.
I'm the boss.
Yes?
Have you ever seen any pretty serious exploits with Bluetooth? And if so, do you know any ways to augment the vulnerabilities? Shield against those vulnerabilities?
Actually, Bluetooth can be used for a lot more stuff, and actually, I'm having problems with Bluetooth, even with my phone, it always tries to connect to like whatever headset it finds all over the place. As far as I know right now, there are not that many uses for Bluetooth. I don't know, maybe connect. It does. I would not trust it. I don't know of any exploits, but I would not trust it. Basically, if you're using it just to dial up, use your cell phone as a modem, I think that's as advanced as you can get with Bluetooth. I don't think you will even dare to go from computer to computer. Yeah. I will not trust it, and I'm telling you, like personally, my phone. The moment I try to make a phone call, if the Bluetooth is on, it's trying to connect right away. Okay, this is something that I don't know about, but somebody here said that Ericsson is getting out of the business of making the Bluetooth chips or the support for the Bluetooth. I hope that that's not the case, and I hope that they try to improve it, because I invested a lot of money on like Bluetooth headsets and dongles and all that big stuff. But, I won't be totally surprised either, so.
Manos, what's your opinion on, I think this year you can see a lot of talk about endpoint security, the various systems of the commercial suppliers who started to try and scan computers before they connect into a network. What's your opinion on What do you think
those are going to
be useful or not useful?
As I said earlier, the more stuff you can throw on security, the better it is. So no question about it, it does add. The problem is, another problem with security is the more security you put on a network, the more difficult you're making. Oh, we have an exclusive room. So the more difficult you make it for people to use the system, or to install the system, or to deploy the system. And of course you have the problem of the cost. So if there is a way, I think that this is a very inexpensive way of approaching it, because it decreases the cost of deployment tremendously. But I think that if somehow we can figure out a way to make it feasible, more of it. Yeah, absolutely. Anybody else?
just since a lot of the questions touch on it, just something that I always see is this balance between usability and security. And do you have anything specific to say about that, or is it?
You want a secure computer? You want a secure computer? Buy one, turn it off, dig about a mile deep hole, throw it in there and cover it with cement. That would be a secure computer. If you want to turn it on and much more like use it, then security starts. Is there a balance between the two? I think what brings the balance is education, what we are doing right now, for example. If the user knows and understands what we just spoke about, I think that they will go the extra step and like put HTTPS instead of HTTP, or use ASCII that we mentioned before instead of just typing their password. They take an extra step and download SSH instead of using Tunnel. So I believe that the balance is education. Educated users that they would not actually tell their username and password on the phone to somebody that they don't know. You can buy the most expensive security software and hardware and anything you can imagine. If one of the users give a username and password to a stranger, they already have a nice day. So, anybody else? Yeah. The question was, can a non-broadcasting wireless network be detected? Actually, it's non-broadcasting, it's SSID. So basically, it's not broadcasting its name. Can it be detected? If there is traffic, sure. If there is no traffic, I'm not sure about that one. I don't know, guys. If you're not broadcasting the SSID, can the network be detected and there is no traffic? When you associate, right. But if there is no traffic, the answer is yes. Because the moment that you're looking around for a network, you are making a request to associate, therefore there is traffic, therefore it can be detected, but it doesn't give you the SSID.
So
it would not be easy to find it, it would not be easy to connect it, but so if you want to do that, that's great, but still do the encryption and double it. Come on, Bobby. Any questions? No? Okay, I guess we're going to get back. All yours. For those of you, brother, who haven't been to Denison before, tomorrow we're going to on Thompson. I think it's 124 Thompson. But we can all hang out here for a few minutes. People are interested in having for the discussion. It's actually what you do is you go out the door, you make a right, you go down, you make a left on Thompson. And you go down to 124 and it's on the right. Denison. Denison. And it will probably most likely be in the back room. For those who...
Cigarette.
73? Oops, I don't know. It's not even dyslexic at that point, huh? Does anybody have any further questions or discussions? Because in the beginning we mentioned some of the organizational changes that we're doing. There's a few other things that we definitely need people to work on. It includes Wes's online BSD tracker application. We're trying to put together a database of all firms that support, develop, use whatever BSD systems in the New York area. And right now, to be honest, it's kind of been dead in the water for a little while because we really had no one to essentially take responsibility for it. We also would like at some point for someone to take on responsibility of dealing with the DMessageD application that's online. But there's a number of other things. I mean, Mark, for instance, will hopefully be taking over corralling more content for a website because
things kind of, you know, bursted up, took off like a rocket when Michael's first got the new website up, but then kind of things, you know, died like a rock, unfortunately, for a while in terms of content submission. And this includes FAQs, how-tos, rants, whatever, that would go online. There's a whole number of useful documents we have up there now that get accessed regularly. We actually want to increase both the level of depth and quality of the stuff that we have online in terms of being service for the community internationally. So if you are interested, definitely contact me offline for any inquiries about roles you could play. Anyway, on that note, I guess round of applause for Manos over here. And I guess we could all just start making our way over to the bar.
And...